If I can make one woman feel much more comfortable with herself about going in her street, walking her own at her own leisurely pace without fear, if I can make one woman go to work feeling that she's being appreciated, then we can start having a truly feminist world order, if that's what we are aiming for.
We are.
Lyt med, når jeg taler med Michelle, professor i globale studier på RUC. Vi taler om, hvor vigtige følelser er, hvor vigtigt det er at anerkende kvinders følelser i samfundet. Vi taler om vold mod kvinder, vi taler om overgreb og frygt. Vi taler om kvindehad, ikke kun fra mænd, også fra andre kvinder. Denne podcast er optaget på engelsk. Ligestilling nu, en podcast af Line Gæsø.
You wanted to talk about the Pope visiting Iraq and
It was just I was really angry. It showed some of the things
Let me tell me about it, because I didn't follow it on the news. I think you see some other news than I do, so
I mean, I teach global politics, right? So I have to be on the ball, so to say, all the time. But no, it was just so symptomatic of the institutional power that the Catholic Church carries. I mean, I respect this Pope because he's trying to do some things differently, and he's trying to break some very old, you know, norms that are deeply embedded in the Vatican and the Catholic Church. But to see him visit, you know, his counterpart in Iraq, who's actually originally Iranian, and then just look at the symbolism of the, you know, the way the Pope was dressed, and his counterpart in Iraq was extremely humble. You know, he hosted him in his home. You could see that it was, you know, very humble sofa, very humble surroundings, very bare. Yeah. And then you have, you know, this presence of the all glorified Pope with, you know, symbolizing the richness of the Catholic Church. And it just threw me and reminded me of when I was just a little girl in a Catholic school, and the nuns used to preach about giving to others and thinking about the poor, and then looking at them, and they symbolized, you know, all that I was contrary to what they were preaching. So, you know, driving BMW vans, and at that time wearing Bata shoes, which was quite an important brand, an expensive brand. And I just grew up asking myself, how is this possible that you have this, you know, this person you're supposed to look up to, you know, narrating and preaching a certain principle, and then actually countering that principle with their own everyday life? It just was too contradictory for me, and very powerful. It went deep down into my DNA. So I grew up questioning this and questioning it, and I was often punished for it. You know, I grew up in the 80s, and at that time, you know, the artist Madonna was very much in vogue, and I just remember me and my friends decided that we're going to wear this big necklace with a big cross and have, you know, earrings with crosses, just to be in vogue. And I remember being in our religion class, and the nun scolded us, and she said, basically, you're in detention for a week because you're offending, you know, the sanctity of the church. And we tried to explain, but there was no listening about, you know, and we were young, we were children, you know, just trying to be, you know, it's part of puberty, right? That you explore, you experiment, you tease out how much you can stretch the borders and the limitations. But, you know, I grew up in that environment, and punishment was big in the Catholic school. So whenever we were disobedient, according to what was framed as disobedience, I remember the nuns coming out with a very thick wooden ruler and hitting us, you know, on the palm of our hands. And that kind of discipline, I think, is probably the reason why I'm a Foucauldian, you know, because Foucault's work is very much about power and knowledge. And that was what I was really struggling with.
Yeah.
How knowledge is produced and who produces knowledge, who produces what is dominant in the everyday narrative, whether it's political, whether it's religious, whether it's economic, and what lies behind this. And there was always, you know, for me, there was always a pointer to power, where power lies. So I'm not surprised that I ended up where I did in my sort of work life, you know, challenging dogmas, challenging dominant discourses, challenging power. And it's very key in the way I teach, in the way I read, in the way I write. It kind of comes back to that very core of my upbringing. Yeah. And the fact, of course, that my puberty was just overshadowed by this, because as young people, of course, we spend a lot of time at school and it forms you. So, yeah.
Thank you very much, Monsieur. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm glad you you want to participate. And will you introduce yourself? Tell me a little about yourself.
Yes, of course. So my name is Michelle Page and I'm originally from Malta. And I'm currently working at Roskilde University as professor in global studies. I'm also associate fellow at Chatham House, the Europe program in London. And I also have associate membership with the Middle East Studies Forum at Deakin University in Australia. So I straddle between being an educator, but I also try to make sure that the research that I produce is very much informed by the general agency of those that I study. So I'm very much in touch with public policy and I try to make my research relevant for policy and often, you know, act as an activist. So it's a lot of activist researching in my work. I wouldn't find my research meaningful for me if it was purely just for the sake of writing books. But I find a lot of meaning in the classroom where my students teach me a lot. And I also find a lot of meaning in the people that I study. So we can talk more about that as we go along, I guess, in the podcast.
Yes. Do you define yourself as a feminist?
I probably wouldn't. I am all for equal rights for all humans, whether they are women or men or consider themselves and define themselves differently. And there's of course a big discussion about whether it's a sexual identity or gender identity. We can, I guess, come to that as well. So I'm all for rights equally for all humans wherever they are in the world, but I think there's a bit of a challenge in the way that the concept of feminism has become almost what I call a conceptual imperialism, that it tries to cover too much and as a result loses the essence of what it originally started off trying to fight for as a struggle, as a movement.
Yeah, and what do you think originally was the definition of feminism?
So from my reading of feminism, and I know that you and others are much more knowledgeable than me on this, but from my readings and my following of the feminist movement, it started off to ensure that women, and women's rights in particular, are considered as part of any policy-making process. So when we think about women's pay at our jobs, whether we look at the amount of work and labor that is put into what we do in our homes, which is often not, of course, priced as a salary or as a wage, that these encounters with women have to be equally considered as those with men. So it started off, I think, as a focus, and rightly so, on women having, you know, equal rights in whichever walk of life they straddle as men. And of course, I also think that it started off as a movement that looked at the rights of minority groups. So not just women, but people who form groups and identify as part of a minority group and therefore their rights as a group in society. So whoever feels underprivileged or is forsaken when it comes to equality in policy or in the eyes of those who make the powerful decisions, it's the fight and the struggle for their equality, for their freedom, for their right as individuals to be equal In, no matter what their gender, no matter what their ethnic identity, no matter what their sexual identity, it's important that we're considered as human. So for me, that is a very important value.
Women's rights are human rights.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. And for me, you know, the concept of women then, of course, is important to reach out to other groups in society who feel mistreated or, whose rights are not equally considered.
And then you think somehow feminism got too broad?
I feel that it's too broad. So recently I was involved in a discussion about whether we should have a European feminist foreign policy. And, you know, my point was that, again, if we're talking about an equal representation of women in the European Parliament, I'm all for that. If we talk about women making decisions equally as men, you know, I'm all for that. But we just need to be very careful, to my mind, that we don't try to capture too many objectives and goals and then lose sight of the core. Yeah, because we are talking in the 21st century and we're still struggling with this today. I mean, I work in a university and we're still talking about the percentage of women who are at different levels, whether assistant, associate professor, you know, professor MSO or full professor. We're talking about representation of female students in the student union. We're still talking about that today. So there's still a lot of work to be done about the very basic parameters of what I deem to be the feminist struggle. So we just need, I think I would caution us to be a little bit careful about not trying to take too many things that we aim to achieve and too fast when the essence of the movement itself is still being fought for.
Yes. Yes, I understand. And I would like to the listeners to know you a little better, to know your background, because right now you live in Denmark, you lived in England, but you grew up in Malta. Will you tell me about the
your
background?
Yeah. Yes, of course. I come from a very humble background. I come from a very working class family. And because of the, you know, dire situation in Malta at the time, I was born in 1970, my father had to seek employment with the British Navy because Malta was then part of the British colonial project. So we were a colonized people. And this, you know, really formed a crucial aspect of my identification because I always felt kind of in between, you know, Europe and the Mediterranean. Malta is actually located in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. So in the search of who I was, you know, I was never quite satisfied with just saying I'm Maltese because my language is actually based on Arabic grammar. But then it has influence from French, Italian and English because of the long British colonial rule in Malta and the Maltese Islands. So there was always this kind of feeling of liminality, you know, which is a state where you feel in between. And, you know, my father going on his work trips on the British Navy regularly meant that I grew up, you know, being very close with my mother. And I had two older sisters and a brother, but I was the youngest. And, you know, once I started to sort of question myself and who I was, I realized that I felt both European, but also strongly, I wouldn't say Middle Eastern or North African, but I felt very strongly Mediterranean. And, you know, I looked at myself and I had features and I could see that I had features that would be seen as both European and Mediterranean. So I kind of, I was very happy with this. I was very proud of this, that I didn't have one identification. I had multiple to you know, to wave on, so to say, to ride on. And I grew up asking myself, how is it that this tiny insular island has, you know, two very powerful regimes? So I was brought up under a very socialist government of Domintov, and my family was socialist. So I attended a lot of meetings where there was a lot of pride in Malta being first and foremost. Of course, Mintov used to be, you know, a very vocal voice against British colonial rule. So that was a formation of me, you know, against the colonial powers. But at the same time, this kind of attraction to Britain, you know, that this was a large country full of opportunities where one was able to flourish on the basis of merit, whereas when I looked at the Maltese society, it was very insular, very corrupt, you know. So I just grew up all the time constantly challenged by these kind of opposing views and opposing sides. And on top of that, there was a very strong power, which was the Catholic Church. So I remember my father coming to us and saying, well, the priest will not allow me to go on my trip for work unless I go and confess. And this was it used to be called the Black Period in Malta, right? So basically, there was a very strong connection between the Catholic Church in Malta and what is called the Partito Nazionalista, which is the conservative party. And they tried to rule by fear, right? So when they were in opposition, they of course tried to challenge the Labour Party in government by instilling this fear in society with the support of the Catholic Church. So I grew up with these social principles of justice and the value of the human and the sense of community, as opposed to, you know, these opposing narratives of you need to do what the church tells you, you need to be, you know, a good Catholic, you need to go to the church and you need to give to the poor. And that kind of instilled in me a huge struggle. And that struggle instilled in me a quest for knowledge, and that I needed to learn more about the history, about the politics, about the economy. And I had a very strong family member who had a lot of influence on me. It was my uncle, my mother's father, who left Malta in the 60s and went to Australia. And one day he sent me this book, which was called, it was a very thick book, and it was called The Secrets of the Vatican. And by starting to read this book, I realized that I should not take what came to me from the Catholic Church as something that I had to abide by. I had to constantly question, because there in that book was a basic premise. You preach one thing, but you do something very different. So we talked about the wealth of the Vatican and the wealth of the Catholic Church, the accumulation of wealth, when, you know, the preaching was all about the poor and giving to the poor. So yeah, I grew up angry and there was a rebel forming in me, and yes. It explains a lot where I am today, right?
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that I think formed me a lot was that I lost my mother, sadly, when I was 13. And I was left with a father who had decided then to come home and be with the family and retire early from the British Navy. So my mom getting sick and then passing away within a matter of months due to cancer left my father deeply depressed. So I also grew up with a sense of responsibility, but I was very young. I was 13 years old, and being responsible for my dad, having responsibility for myself, because by then my sisters and my brother were married and they had their own life, but basically relying on myself meant that I had to take decisions very quickly, and I lost my youthhood.
Yeah.
I jumped from a child growing with the sense of curiosity, with the sense of rebellion, with the sense of anger, to suddenly being given, you know, by circumstances, a huge responsibility, not only for myself, but for my father. So I grew very fast. And I think mentally, I kind of speeded up the process. And therefore, I felt very alienated from the children in my classroom, who I thought were spoiled and didn't see things the way I saw them. So again, it threw me into a zone where I felt very different. So this led me very early on, once my dad and I could have a conversation, and I was about 20, 21, I was at university then. And I sat down with my father one day and I said, now I've done what I could. Now it's time for me to take my life path. And I did something extremely radical for Malta at that time. I decided to live on my own. And this came with stigma.
And how old were you?
I was 21.
Yeah.
This came with a huge stigma, because while I was studying...
Because you're a woman or...?
Well, I'll explain. I was studying very hard, and I was studying very hard because I had this deep quest for knowledge, and the more I knew, the more I needed to know. So that was one. But on the other hand, I was working very hard, doing a lot of part-time jobs in order to be able to get independence and to question my own society. So when I decided to live on my own, I'll give you an example what I mean by this. My dad, being a person who was in the British Navy, was luckily for me very open-minded. So he kind of blessed me and said, I thank you, my dear daughter. It's your life. And of course, we'll still be friends and you're welcome here whenever you want. But of course, I respect that. That was the message from my dad. But from parents of my classmates, I got phone calls saying things like, you whore, you are doing this in order to have an easy way in which you can live your life freely with lots of men coming your way. And it was completely the opposite of what I was searching for. I just needed the space to develop as Michelle, not as Michelle being my father's daughter who had to take care of him. And I just needed to disassociate myself from that role, because now I really needed to search for what Michelle's meaning in life was. What was my purpose in this life? I was searching for what I was going to do with my life, with my education, with the way I had developed as a person. So I was far from thinking about my sexuality. I actually grew up not really thinking about that, also because I had a very bad experience when I was just a year after my mom passed away. There was a stint when my sister and my father had a conversation, and they thought that it was too much on me to be taking care of my dad. So my sister said, you know, I'll take her over to our house for a few months or so and see how that goes. And again, I was angry because this was a decision that was taken where I was not part of that decision. And this came on top of the fact that when my mother was buried, my brother and my sister decided that I was not going to my mother's funeral because I shouldn't be privy to that, which did a lot of harm to me. So there were many decisions that were made on my behalf by supposedly my caring brothers and sisters, who probably didn't know better. They probably did it for my own good in their eyes, but it did me a lot of harm. So when I moved to my sister, just to cut a long story short, my brother-in-law tried to abuse me. And luckily for me, my father and my sister came on time and it was rescued, but the damage was done. So I actually grew up feeling very angry with men, with this brother-in-law of mine, with my father, because he was away at the British Navy and not really being with the family. So I had that kind of underneath anger at him, although I understood why he did it. My brother, because he took certain decisions that were not for the better of me. So I actually grew up very angry at men. You could say I was very angry. So I didn't trust men. And I grew up trying to say to myself, you can only trust yourself. Because out there, it's a pack of wolves who will do things for you that might be, in their eyes, things for the better. But it might not end up like this. So you need to protect yourself. You need to protect yourself from possible harm. So, you know, the reason why I wanted to seek this space for myself was precisely to put all these ideas and experiences together and say, where are you, Michelle, in the world? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go? So I took all this in, these phone calls from angry mothers who were calling me names and easy and all this. And I just decided, okay, I'm just going to block this.
But it was mostly women who gave
it. It was mothers.
It was mothers.
They were trying to protect their daughters.
It was not fathers that said, you were...
No, it was mothers.
Yeah.
They were trying, I think, to, in their eyes, to protect their daughters from being with me because I was a rebel. I was challenging society. I was doing something that is not toward a good...
Is this a cultural reaction or a religious reaction, do you think?
I think most of the mothers who called me were very religious.
Yeah.
So they would be the kind of mothers who would abide by the dogma of the church.
So it's the Catholic...
why I had to talk about Malta being a small island, which was colonized for a very long time, that has its cost when you're colonized by a powerful, you know, empire. So people were always trying to be in search of who they are, yeah? Because Malta being small, yes, but it has a history. It has a very important history. And, the nation grew up with that kind of anger and dilemma, you know. But on the other hand, I had to talk about this presence, this almighty presence of the church, which for me was at times even more powerful than the official state. So I call it the deep state. It's the deep state, like the military in Egypt, which dictates policy, but is not always visible. Yeah, so you have ways and means of influencing society and politics and the economy, but not being very visible about it, which is more dangerous. So when I moved on my own, I said, fine, I'll just block this. I'll just shun it. I'll you know, put it behind me and I'll search for what I want. And it was there and then, during that period where I spent a lot of time reading and thinking and walking and reflecting, that I decided my future is not in Malta. My future is somewhere where I can have my own mind, allow myself to flourish, question, be allowed to question things, but I will always be where I have merit to be. I don't want to be in a system where I need to get a job because I need to know this person and this. I hated that system, you know, and I saw it happening all the time around me. You know, I had an elder sister who had left Malta at 17, who went to London. So there was always another connection with Britain. Me and my mum used to visit my sister on a regular basis to London. I had the connection with my father being in the British Navy when we used to visit him in Portsmouth. So the automatic attraction was the UK. So then I met my husband now, my partner. He was Norwegian. And we sat down and we thought, okay, how can we be together? And one way to be together was to continue our studies. And my first degree was in business and marketing. And after having worked in an offshore bank, I realized, goodness, this is really not what I believe in. I realized that I was actually marketing, you know, Russian money, which there were many questions about where it was coming. So I handed in my resignation at this bank I was working at, and I decided I wanted to take a completely different track from business. So I decided on international relations, which was something that really, for me, covered what I wanted to be in search of. This world's coming together, what formed the history, the politics, the economy of societies, of governments that made decisions on behalf of societies, etc. So that's when I undertook my master's in international studies at Warwick University. And it was a very informative year for me, extremely informative. I finally found myself. I finally, you know, found this Michelle that had been so long searching for who she wanted to be, what she represented, what principles, you know. So out of that year of study grew an intense quest for more. So I went back to Malta. I basically worked very hard again in the bank to basically cover my loans, my student loans. And then I pursued my PhD studies. And then I went to Portsmouth and I did 3 years there, partly in Norway because I was doing some research at the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs in Oslo. And then in 1999, me and my partner decided that we wanted to move back to the UK. Because I didn't feel Norway was at that time very, very receptive to otherness. I felt very much another.
Yeah. But you come from a culture where so many different cultures are mixed.
Yeah.
In Malta, I think. Yeah. And then you go to a country where
it was very homogeneous. Yeah. I remember, you know, I was having this research stay at the Norwegian Institute of International Studies, and thanks to a very nice mentor of mine, I was given a desk there because I was doing my PhD. And quickly I realized that the Norwegians start work at 7:30, they have lunch at 11:30, and then they go and pick up their kids at 3:30. So I had to change my whole way of being. I mean, as a Mediterranean, I probably have breakfast at 11:30. But I wanted to learn. I started learning Norwegian. I wanted to be part of this team, but I used to sit at the lunch table and nobody would look at me and say a word. They would continue speaking in Norwegian, even though I was trying so hard to learn Norwegian. And that really left a mark on me about Scandinavia, I should say. And ironically, my husband is Norwegian, but he's a different Norwegian, I think. But you know, it made me think, how can a society, I know Norway is rich, But how can a society completely close itself off from learning from other, you know, societies? I know Malta is small, but I'm sure that we can enrich the conversation if we engage in a dialogue. You know, that was always my quest. That for me, you know, in Malta, if you sit on a bus, you start chatting with the person next to you, even if you don't know this person. And through that grows a conversation. So I grew up with, you know, being open to learn from anyone, whatever their walk of life, whatever their background. I always had this questioning in me. So I found Norwegian society extremely closed. So I said to my partner, I can't live here. So, you know, thankfully my partner and I agreed. We decided to go to the UK. So we moved to the UK in 1999, and I spent till 2014 there. And Britain, I can say, is my home. I call it my adopted home because it's not my place of birth. But and this is interesting now that we have Brexit, but I saw Britain as a very multicultural society that truly lived up to what I understood by multiculturalism, where difference was celebrated, where everybody brought something to the society, and as a result, the society grew and grew and grew. And I mean by this not economically, but as a society, as a society that was thinking and free and you know, making the everyday life better for everyone. And so in many ways, it was very satisfying for me because I moved, you know, in my educational sort of pathway, I moved quickly and became a professor on the basis of merit. I worked very hard and I, you know, I could see that I was appreciated for what I was bringing in. And I remember that when moving from SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is a very left-leaning university, to University of Birmingham, which is a very conservative university, I could see the difference, for example, in the way women were treated on the job. So I fought extremely hard. And as I said, I don't describe myself as a feminist, but I could see, for example, that when we're sitting making decisions on a council meeting, a research council meeting, it was women who were asked to do the admin work or women who were often given the teaching tasks. But the thinking, you know, the strategic thinking was left for men. And I started, you know, instilling in my colleagues who had powerful positions as men to say, but hold on a second. Here are all these fantastic women who are doing all these very interesting jobs. Why don't we bring them in and include their voices in these decisions? I mean, this is the future of our university. This is the future of the education of our students. This is where we're discussing how we can make our students' employment better after they graduate. And I'm sure that a lot of my colleagues who are women have a lot to give. So slowly, slowly, I wasn't fighting this on a feminist agenda. I was fighting it purely for the equality of all who are representing my department. So when I had to come to Denmark in 2014, I left Birmingham feeling very sad on many ways, but I was very happy that I looked at my department, and whenever I saw a meeting, there was equal representation from women and men colleagues, and the same thing with our students' bodies. So it gave me a sense of this is worth struggling for. This is worth fighting for, because it's not just about the presence of women there, but everybody can benefit from this.
Yeah.
You see my point? So my point is more about what happens by making this process come through. So as a result of that, what is the outcome of that? That is more what I'm interested in. And for me, that kind of justice, social justice for all, is more key in struggles. Whatever the movement.
In my point of view, it sounds like a feminist.
Yes, I'm sure that. So maybe, you know, there's a hidden feminist in me.
Yeah, but yeah. I know a lot of people are not comfortable with being a feminist. Also in Denmark, I mean, even though we say we do have gender equality, a lot of people say so. But if you ask them if they are feminist, they will. They would say they will not identify themselves as a feminist. So that's That's very interesting, I think.
A lot
of Danish people will say, I'm a humanist.
I think I would subscribe to that as well. And I think maybe that tells us something about what has happened to the notion of feminism.
Yeah.
It's been probably misused or, you know, abused in so many ways. So it's done something to harm the very concept of feminism.
Yeah.
So that's important in itself to me. That a cause that has such important foundational values has either been taken over by, you know, others and
angry,
abused.
Angry women.
Maybe angry women themselves, you know, who feel that at the bottom line there's a huge injustice. And we can talk about this forever. For me, you know, there's a huge thing that I would like to perhaps maybe take it as my struggle from now on after a personal experience. But there's a lot of invisible violence against women that nobody talks about. Organizations are silent. And, you know, I was reflecting about it this morning and I was trying to think, where has this moral collapse come about that empowers men to act in certain ways that they deem to be in their right to do or they deem legitimate to do without consequence? Yeah, so we've had the events in London just a few days ago. But for me, it goes beyond that. Yeah, of course, it's a crime and it's, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a woman to be walking in the streets and be, you know, abducted and murdered. But there is an everyday violence that is completely invisible in the way that, you know, masculinity has become so toxic. And of course, we have the Me Too campaign that is, I think, a good, you know, step in the right direction. But there's so much more work that needs to be done. And we're talking about this in the 21st century. Yeah, so when you see, for me, you know, the feminist movement was at its height in the 1968-69 period, right? When you look back and you ask yourself, yes, we have the right to vote. Yes, you know, we're talking about equality of women in boards of companies, etc. But what about the everyday? Why is it that a lot of women feel isolated or silenced in their everyday, whether it's at work, whether it's in their family situation? I don't think there's enough of a discussion about this. And I would like your podcast maybe to look into this because it's so important. And yet, you know, a lot of women are afraid to talk about it. And we need to bring it in an open discussion.
Yeah.
But I'm also talking about, you know, for me, if a man does not accept that it's important to understand, if a woman feels fear, if a woman feels she's hurt, it doesn't have to be seen, it doesn't have to be shown. If she says she's feeling something, that is very important. And I think a lot of men don't understand that because they boil down emotions. Oh, you're a woman. You're emotional. Emotions don't matter. Actually, emotions matter a lot. And I'm not just talking about women here. There are many humans who feel they are being violated every day, but are so scared of talking about it because the structure is constraining or the structure is silent or the structure encourages masculine toxicity, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting subject. I think of your story about your youth when you moved to live alone, then it's the women who are calling you and
stigmatizing me.
Yeah. It's not the men. I see this force or this hatred of feelings and femininity and so on. I see it in women as well as I see it in men.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I often experience myself, even in my professional life, that women can be very toxic as well. There's a lot of envy, deeply embedded envy. So rather than supporting colleagues who are doing well in their job, who get praise from, you know, their targeted audience, whether it's students, colleagues, whatever, there are many women who put a lot of constraints in the pathway and can be very vengeful with spite. I completely agree with you. But to me, it's important to ask, how is it that those women came about to be and feel, you know, the need to revenge or to feel spiteful? What is it that they have experienced? And I'm not blaming all this on masculine toxicity, by far. But if I look back to my childhood, those mothers who stigmatized me, they were the ones who were listening mostly to priests, because the Catholic Church, yeah, up until very recently, is hugely macho and male dominated. It's very patriarchal. So they were influenced by what they heard in those masses, in those congregational, you know. So it comes from somewhere. And of course, it also comes from what you experience in the home, the patriarchy you experience in the home. So we cannot completely disconnect. Yeah. And I think the same for my male colleagues. We need to understand, where is it that certain, you know, hatred for women comes from, or fear of women?
Yeah, maybe.
There's a lot of fear of women,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
I can see it. I mean, it's not talked about, but I can visually see it in male.
But you see the fear of the feminine. You see that already in Christianity and also in the Muslim religions. I mean, it, you see it in, yeah, the
I think
of seduction or
yeah. I think, you know, it's a toxic composition when you have dogmas, whether they are political or religious. I'm not a religious person myself. I'm not a practicing Catholic, but there is one principle that I grew up with consistently throughout my life, and I will always pass it on to my children, and that is that I must do every day unto others what I would like others to do unto me. So if my expectation is that others respect me for who I am, and I am a human, I make mistakes, I can't always be right, those are things that I have to accept, then it's a two-way, yeah? But there's also a context. And sometimes, I mean, if we talk about the neoliberal context that we are living in, right? It's a context that encourages competitiveness, individualism, greed, materialism. These are all things that go completely away from, you know, the principles I enshrine, which is community, social justice, you know, the sense of the importance of taking care of others if you want to take care of yourself. And that is something that is so powerful that it has taken our everyday life and we don't see it. Yeah, so you go to your children's school environment and you hear of parents boasting about this house that they bought in the best, most expensive street in this city and this car. And our children are growing up in that environment. So they come home and they say, you know, Mama, this family, they're really well off, you know, they're really rich. When those conversations would not necessarily have been part of your family conversation. So, you know, the role of the woman and the man, whether you're a father or a mother, you're a colleague, our role has changed as a result of this embeddedness of the system, you know, this structural system that is so, I mean, it's the capitalist system, right? So we need to go back to the roots of movements and the roots of these core struggles. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at. And to ask ourselves, what is it exactly that we're fighting for? Are the principles that we started to fight for in the late 60s still applicable today? Or do we have a different environment in which we are now struggling? And therefore, is there more being imposed on us that we have to fight against? Do we use the same mechanisms to fight? Do we bring together the same, you know, like-minded people? Because don't forget that another, you know, very powerful presence in our lives today is populism. And where does that come from? You know, it comes precisely from hugely smart individuals who know what fear does. So we come back to emotions and the importance of emotions. And when fear is instilled deep into a human being, I mean, totalitarianism during the Nazis, this is what it was on. I mean, Hannah Arendt wrote so deeply about this. She spent her life, writing about this. So that's where I feel maybe we need to come to. What is it that instills fear, whether it's men about women or women about women or women about men? Where is this fear coming from? How can we put it on the table and address it and talk genuinely about it so that we can address it? Because otherwise harm will continue to be done.
Yeah, and we have to talk about it without fighting amongst the sexes. I mean, we have to be careful not to make a war between men and women.
We're a community at the end of the day. Humanity is a community. So we see from COVID, right? No matter where you are in the world, no matter what your sexuality, we are all affected by it. It's the same with climate change. No matter where we are, nobody will escape this. And I think it boils down to the feminist struggle, if that's what you prefer to refer to it. And I'm quite okay with that. But
no, but I'm curious what you refer it to.
For me, it's the substance of what we're struggling for, you know, and I don't care, to be honest, what the label is.
No.
If you want to call it feminist struggle, then be it. But let's be clear.
Labels change all the time.
But let's be clear about what we're talking about, so that we don't lose the essence of the very struggle we're here for, you know.
Yeah.
It's a big one.
There's another thing. I mean, you talk about populism, but I also think we are creating a society that is more and more binary. I mean, like, either you like it or you hate it. You put a like on it or a dislike on the social media.
Yeah,
and
that
also makes your mind black or white.
Yes, but binaries will not lead us to a fairer and more just world, because we saw it happen with Brexit.
Yeah.
The conversation was either you're for the EU or you are against the EU.
Exactly.
So, and here I blame my own academy. I left Facebook in anger about this, and I'll tell you a little bit why. But I was trying to follow the debate about Brexit, trying to understand this society that I so admired, so much believed in. I spent 14 years in the United Kingdom. For me, it was a pedestal of multiculturalism. How can suddenly the public discussion be about immigrants as the others, Poles as the others, even Italians and French and Germans? Suddenly it was all about Englishness, and, you know, very much probably centered more in England than Wales, Ireland or Scotland. So I was so shocked with this. And then what I found is that academics created their own bubble. Of course, most academics were for Britain to stay in the EU. But then one visit I had in Malta, and my sister and I went for a coffee, and she sat down and she said to me, "Michelle, can you please, in simple terms, explain to me what Brexit is all about?" And she hit the nail on the head. I thought, academia is losing it. We are talking in a language that is way beyond, that nobody understands. So how can we actually explain to the everyday citizen what are the benefits for Britain to be in the European Union? What is the collective advantage of being part of a regional organization like this? What does it mean for the everyday citizen? We were losing that. And that's why Brexit happened. So, and that's why populism came about, because these, and I have to say, mainly male populist rulers, from Orban in Hungary to Trump in the US, they understood the very core of fear in people. And that particular card of otherness as the threat, as the burden to our society, was so strong and potent that they are waving on it. And they still do, even though populism maybe have been challenged a bit during COVID now. But that's why I'm saying, you know, unless we have a conversation about what makes us human. If I am afraid, yes, I am human. It's very natural to be afraid. But then let's talk about it. Why am I afraid? It's the same about talks, you know, about the Metropolitan Police. People are afraid to walk in the streets. Well, abduction and murders don't happen every day. They do happen, don't get me wrong. But let's try to understand what makes women afraid of walking in the streets in the first instance. Right? Because there was a similar discussion in the UK about when we lived there, about not allowing your children to play in the garden because there's this boogeyman who's going to come and abduct them after the case of Madeleine in Portugal. That is going to instill more fear.
Yes.
That is going to make things worse. That is going to make humanity more afraid. That is not conducive to a healthy society, to my mind. I think we need to talk about what it means to be a free person. What does freedom mean for us today? For me to feel a free person, what does it mean? That I come to my work and I close my door and I isolate myself? No, that's not freedom. Freedom is to go out and know that I'm accepted the way I am, that I can err because I'm human, I do make mistakes, but that what I do can also be appreciated. And what can others gain from what I can contribute to my society? And if that happens across nations and across humanity, then I think we'll have a better world. That's what humanism is for me.
Yes. What is so interesting also about your background, being now in North Europe, coming from the south of Europe, and having the Catholic Church with you in all this, in your upbringing, I always see the equality discussion go wrong when cultures are clashing, when we misunderstand each other because of religion or culture.
Well, I can tell you that as a Southern European, I have experienced discrimination myself, even though probably I'm considered white. But as I mentioned with my case and my experience in Oslo, and I experienced it in Denmark as well, but there's fear.
Yeah.
When we don't make the time to get to know someone, we are afraid of them. And that's a human element in us. So that's why I'm for dialogue. If somebody is afraid of me because of how I look, then I invite them to come and have a cup of coffee with me. And it's the same whether a community is defined as Muslim, or whether it's defined as Jewish, or whether it's defined as Catholic, or whether it's defined from this sect or that sect. We may have our presuppositions, our prejudices, and those are the elements in our humanity that need to be addressed. Because at the end of the day, we're all human. I come back to that. So, you know, if my child comes and says, Mama, this semester I have two new children in my classroom. One is from Syria and one is from Yemen. I say to my son, let's celebrate that. Let's ask, what is Syrian culture about? What is Yemeni culture about? What can these new colleagues of yours bring to the classroom? Rather than, oh dear, They're probably Muslim. Oh dear. You know, and then all the prerogatives and negative judgments, right? And one of the areas I work on is integration of migrants, actually. And I've been working on a project in regards to migrants in Denmark. And I sadly see this in the governmental discourse. It's a very negative construction and depiction of migrants. But then, on the other hand, I also work with a lot of NGOs in Denmark. And the amount of respect I have for all those Danes who volunteer, who give a lot of their time for others, is just explosive, which, you know, dims the power of the official government discourse. But sadly, it's government policy that has a huge impact on the way people vote, because there's also the role of the media here, but also on the way that then societies come together. So then we end up with what in Denmark used to be called, up until a few days ago, ghettos. You know, so we stigmatize, we put them, you know, out of sight, out of mind, rather than celebrating difference. I mean, I was very surprised when
It's the clash between populism and humanism.
Yes, you could say that it's partly that, but there's also this greed for power.
Yeah, yeah.
And our social democratic party in Denmark.
And how to get power is through populism.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you know, if someone had to come and ask me today, what do you think the Social Democratic Party in Denmark or in other European countries represents today? I would answer very shortly. I would say far away from the principles of social democracy. I mean, the language of the Social Democratic Party in Denmark is worse than the Danish People's Party. I mean, that is something to actually capture that kind of negative discourse of the migrant as the burden, of the migrant as the rapist, of the migrant as, you know, really ruining our Danish society. I'm sorry, that is not the kind of society that I feel comfortable living in. It instills in me a deep questioning of which society I'm living in. Am I being accepted for who I am? Of what I can contribute to this society rather than whether I'm a Catholic or whether I'm from South Europe. For me, that doesn't matter. What matters is what we can contribute to our society to make the society healthier. So I think we need to challenge much more. Our struggle is very, very much at the beginning. There's so much work to be done, and there are so many movements, and yet their work is not, you know, here I blame the media as well. We give more limelight to the official government narratives than to the hard work of a lot of well-meaning people who are working in, you know, civil society organizations and NGOs. So it goes at that very macro level, but then it seeps into the meso level and it seeps into the micro level. So what happens at that deep government structure is just, you know, becoming more and more embedded in our societies. And I don't think this augurs well for the future of humanity, because we're made to be together. You know, Adam and Eve,
yes,
were put in the same garden, and one of them made a mistake, and they both had to suffer as a consequence.
That's so, a Christian
yeah.
story.
So there's my Catholic my Catholic background, right? Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting story. If you had to decode it, about men and women being dependent on each other, yeah, about humanity being one, and that if we go down one track, we have a big chance of pulling everyone towards that direction. But if we go another direction, we also have the opportunity to. So in the end, it's about good and evil, you know. And I think about Hannah Arendt and her work on evil. And we shouldn't allow evil to rule.
No.
Yeah, I wanted actually to tell you that there's a lot of talk about a crisis, you know. It's a political crisis, it's an economic crisis, but I actually think we have a humanitarian crisis. Yeah. I think we're back to the very, very bad period of the early 1900s up to, you know, the end of the Second World War. I don't want to be a pessimist, but I feel that, sadly, history has not taught us enough. You know, we're kind of going back to making the old mistake of talking about one dominant race, you know, one dominant, and it's about whiteness. Mm-hmm. And that's not how our world society is made of, you know. But we're back to that, and it's very sad that in spite of all the knowledge that has been produced about the mistakes of the past, we are back there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they say history repeats itself. And on the one hand, that's true, but we should also go to the deep, you know, shelves of our libraries and read a little bit about what that kind of narrative did to societies.
Yeah.
How it brought the worst of the worst of humanity, and what I would like to see is the best of the best of humanity rather than the worst of the worst.
That's why I think it's so important to talk about feminism.
Mm.
At least the way I see it is that if we can make the future more feminine, then there's still time to save humanism and the world. To change all those structures, change the structures in our society to make to have more value on care work and less value of being productive and growth and things like that.
I think you hit something very, very pertinent for me. I think what has happened is that as a human, I'm considered a unit in a production line.
Yeah.
So in academia, you are measured constantly on the basis of how much you produce. Everything has to be calculated with a number, right? That's why I was referring to the neoliberal model, yeah? That yeah. becomes part of the system of devaluing yeah. what it makes us to be human.
Exactly.
So rather than seeing us as a holistic human being that brings in so much in terms of our efforts, in terms of making our community grow bigger, we are constantly being monitored and disciplined and, you know, and measured as what we can bring out in numerical terms. And that is where we lost our humanity.
That's why in some ways we can look about the on the COVID crisis as also a blessing in disguise, that maybe it makes us look upon our everyday life, our children's school days and our working days in a different way. I would really hope that we get more value into the families and to look upon it like maybe there are different ways to work and to go to school and not stress ourselves so much and not... I would really like that the children would not become a production unit. So this school day, it resembles the working day right now. Mm. And I would like it to be different. And I hope that the COVID crisis will make the whole society look different upon what is a working day and what is a school day and how can we look different upon this so we are can spend more time with our children and our families and the children also have a different upbringing than they used to.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you both in terms of being together as a family, because we're kind of used to everybody going out in their own way, right? The children go to school, we go to work. So what it means to be as a family together, but also it taught us a lot about community. You know, I mean, in my street where I live, you know, suddenly we had to think of individuals who are living on their own.
Yeah.
Who couldn't maybe go and yeah. get what they needed in terms of food, maybe hospital care, so medical care. And that leap of faith to start to think about others. And that if others are made to feel better, then it will make us all better. It's going beyond the thinking about the self, only yeah. about the individual. Because I think that is what has cursed humanity.
Yeah.
That we are so pushed to think about ourselves and how I am going to improve my position in my society, in my work, in my, you know, street, in my community. And then leaving very little, if any, space to think about others. Yeah. So there's a lot of joy in helping others achieve. It's just like in the classroom, you know, yeah. when my student comes after 3 years at Roskilde University and says, "Michelle, I've just landed this job in my dream civil society organization or my dream international organization." It makes me so happy.
Yeah.
And if we can have that kind of joy out of others' achievements, I think it will start a different process. So if, coming back to our conversation, if I can make one woman feel much more comfortable with herself about going in her street, walking her own, at her own leisurely pace without fear, if I can make one woman go to work feeling that she's being appreciated, then we can start having a truly feminist world order, if that's what yeah. we are aiming for.
We are.
I'm still up, I mean, hopefully post-COVID, if there is such a thing as post-COVID, we can have more, you know, assemblies where people actually meet in the square, if possible, and, you know, by the lake. People can actually walk and talk and accept that there are different perspectives to see the world. That is, for me, what an education is about. you talked about our children at school. If all teachers in all classrooms can actually teach about accepting different points of views of seeing the world, I think that's the biggest lesson we can learn in life, to accept difference. And that we often need to be listeners rather than always making the talk, right? Because we are bombarded by people who feel almost an entitlement to talk a lot and talk and talk and talk and talk, but they don't listen. And that's a big problem if we don't listen to sometimes even those that maybe we don't really respect.
Different kind of views.
You know, you need to, if somebody is strongly feeling, and that's why I bring it down to feeling, if somebody is strongly feeling something, then that person has the right to express himself or herself or itself. Because of the sheer fact that that person is a human. It's the same when we talk about, you know, refugees and asylum seekers. For me, at the end of the day, a person in distress is a human. As a human, I have a moral obligation to do whatever I can to help that person, not to send him to a country where he will be abducted, put in prison and tortured. That's the bottom line. That's what I would like our children to think about when they grow.
Yeah.
There's a very nice, actually Russian philosopher I like a lot. His name is Mikhail Bakhtin. And he has a very nice piece about dialogue. And he has, I wrote a piece about it, because he has this idea that a true dialogue between two people can only occur when both are prepared to be on listening mode.
Yes.
If I am here and I am curious and I'm looking forward to listen to what you have to say, Lena, then I am a holistic person, because I'm open to learn, to grow. And if you do the same, then we're both in that position and then we grow together. It's like in a marriage, right? If two people come together in a marriage, if one person is suffocated from growing, then they cannot grow as a couple. But if both see themselves as individuals in the sense of supporting each other's development and growth, then they will grow as a couple. So that's, I mean, a kind of idea of humanity for me. So it's a bit, you know, when we talk about COVID and we say, if undocumented migrants are not given the vaccine, then we cannot talk about herd immunity. It's the same about humanity. If one group is deprived of their rights, of their sense of belonging, of their sense of feeling human and being respected as humans and given the rights as humans, then we cannot be proud of a society and talk about a democracy or a, you know, a society based on equal rights. We can't do that.
But it's a completely invisible problem in Denmark that we have immigrants that are not registered in Denmark.
We have children in camps in Denmark that are not being given an education.
Not only in camps. We have, I think the numbers are 200 women gave birth since for the last 10 years in Denmark that are not registered. And that those are only the ones we know about. And we only know them because of the NGOs that work with these people. So we do have, we do have people living here in the dark.
The invisible others.
And we never talk about it in Denmark.
No.
Because it's not a problem in Denmark.
No.
So to speak.
That's not the narrative we want to sell Denmark on. I mean, you spoke, you know, we spoke about corruption in the south, but I can tell you that having lived in Norway and Denmark, and I know also the context of Finland and Sweden through many projects, there's also corruption in the north of Europe. But again, we don't talk about it like we talk about corruption in the south. In the south, it's become a joke, you know, because we're kind of used to it. But I actually find it even more violent to have corrupt systems that are not even seen or talked about.
They're
put under the rug. They're put under the rug. And we move on. I mean, the Norwegian prime minister has just broken the COVID rules. She made a 60th birthday party in a restaurant and in her private home. Let's see if she's going to resign. You know what she came out to say? She said, oh, I didn't understand the rules or read the rules properly. But you're making those rules. I mean, it's something very basic that you have, you know, the representative of a democratic country actually vocally saying in public that she has not read the rules properly. How can you then talk about a normative dimension of this society as a democratic society? And then you look down to the south and say, oh, they are corrupt. It is Greece and Italy and Malta and Cyprus. They are corrupt. That makes me very angry because I have seen, even in Denmark, very corrupt practices. Yeah. And they are not talked about. They are just put under the carpet. Oh, we don't talk about corruption in Denmark. It's, you know.
But it's a very interesting subject, this, because I see the same with gender equality in Denmark. But maybe up until we had the Me Too discussion this autumn, I still struggle to find liberal politicians to speak about feminism, because there is gender equality, they would say. It's only the person who chooses it. So they do not acknowledge the gender inequality in the structures of the society. And I think maybe now, this is not only the politicians, it's also the people living in Denmark. A lot of them will say, we do have gender equality.
Well, you can see what happened during COVID, and this is through my experience with different communities, but who took the brunt of homeschooling?
Yeah.
That is a question you can ask. I mean, I had many discussions with many colleagues, and it was mostly female colleagues who took the brunt of homeschooling. Who took the brunt of the additional, you know, tasks that were imposed on every family? It was women. But I would be very curious if there was a survey, actually, because from my conversations with many Danish colleagues and friends, they actually are accepting of the fact that Denmark has a long way to go to really talk about gender equality, to have gender equality, because there are some deeply problematic structures in different sectors in Denmark. It's not, you know, that's why we come back to the original discussion we had, but it's not just about having women on a board.
No.
It's not just about that. It's about having what you can contribute, accepted, worked on, understood as something that can contribute. You know, people need to feel dignity, valued.
I think most women, I mean, when they get children, they will not leave their children unless they know that the children are being well taken care of. Mm. In kindergarten, in school, everywhere. They will never put in a workload of 60 hours a week if the children are suffering. So as long as we are still fighting with too few teachers in the schools and in the kindergartens and so on, then we cannot create a society where the mothers will say, oh, I leave my children here and they are safe and sound and I go to work. We have all these structures are not...
The everyday.
The everyday life is so difficult if you have a full workload as a woman, because you will prioritize, first of all, when you're pregnant, but also when you have the children, when they go to the dentist and the doctors and so on and so on. If you don't have time for that in your everyday life, you would choose to work part-time or take days off.
Yeah.
And then it's difficult to make the way through the...
Yeah. I mean, an interesting statistic I would be interested in is how many women are actually on sick leave due to burnout.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting statistic in Denmark.
Yeah.
And because of all these additional moments in the everyday life when you have to do this balancing, constant balancing, that does something to your brain.
Yeah, the work-life balancing.
Because you constantly have to work that out. You know, I have this important meeting. At the same time, my doctor is calling me for an appointment for my daughter. You know, the dentist needs to see my other child. And it's so many demands on us as humans, I think. But where is that division of labor going?
And we want, as parents and as society, we want our children to have a good upbringing, to have a mm-hmm. good childhood and being taken care of. That is in everybody's interest, I think. So we need to find solutions to how we can fit this in with the work load we have.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in places like France, there are debates about reducing the hours per week of work.
Yeah.
And I think I would go for, I'd rather, you know, sit at my office and have a concentrated 4 hours than officially having 8 hours, but most of them will be disturbed by worries of family responsibilities, right? So that is also what perhaps you would call a feminist policy, but I would call it a family supportive policy, where the family as a unit is appreciated because it's the core of our society. And if we have problems in families, then there will be problems in societies, right? So if we don't take care of a core unit of our society, yeah. of course we're going to have societies who are suffering from suicidal rates and traumatic rates. And you see the increase. I mean, now we are talking a lot about, you know, the repercussions on mental health from the COVID lockdown. And I think we also need to talk about supportive mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Because if people are not going to be able to get back to work once we do or will be able to in the way we used to, then time has to be given for those, you know, with mental challenges to make time for them to get better.
Yeah.
And again, you know, if many women had to homeschool, had to take care of many other tasks at home that normally they would not, you know, have to, there will be huge repercussions on that. So policy needs to start being thought about now rather than when, you know, the bubble bursts and then we have to face the music, as we say in English.
Yeah. But shorter work weeks would definitely be a good step forward.
And to also make societies appreciate what is really mattering in our lives every day.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just work. You talked about our children being brought up with that kind of thinking as well, you know. So also to send messages to the younger generation that actually there's more to humanity than just work.
Yeah.
We are not slaves.
No. And we can make a society work without such a huge workload on everybody. I believe so.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned this. You know, I've been thinking a lot about it actually, in terms of how many psychologists are now themselves talking about being burnt out with so many demands on them coming from various people from different sectors, right? So even if those who are there to take care of us are actually burnt out, then there's something very seriously wrong.
Yeah.
Social workers,
yeah.
You know. Having to take time out after 3 years because they're burnt out. Think about our nurses, think about, I mean, you know mm-hmm. more than me about this, but all those people who are on the front line trying to care for our society and the damages that are being done to our society, and then they themselves suffering as a consequence, then yeah. we will end up in a very bad place.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hope it was useful.
Yes, very much.
Ligestilling nu, en podcast af Line Gæsø. Tak fordi du lyttede med. Gå ind på hjemmesiden ligestilling.nu. Se mere på Facebook, Instagram eller LinkedIn. Ligestilling nu. En podcast af Line Gæsø.